everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to bring you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to a new show every Wednesday at noon on the Heritage Radio Network, and you can always find us at restaurantguysradio.com.
Good afternoon, Mark.
Hey, Francis, how are you?
I'm doing great. You know, I went to a restaurant recently that I didn't actually get a chance to talk to you about before we came on the air, so I thought, why not
You'd
talk about it now?
You'd love to surprise me with little nuggets while we're on the air.
You know, we had lunch, we had a business meeting at a restaurant where we were invited the other day, and that was just, it was a 2.5 hour meeting, and it was just awful. I mean, and the business meeting was fine, and the people we were with were great, but it was unacceptable.
You know, more and more I see people having business meetings, more and more again, I should say, I see people having their business meetings over dinner. And I just think that's such a civilized way. You know, you have to extend your day.
Yep.
You know, you had your 8-hour business day already, and now you have to extend it because something didn't get done or more work needs to get done, or you're meeting with somebody new. I just think it's so civilized to have that business meeting at a restaurant where it's comfortable, where people are going to take care of you. But
pick a place with a good food, will you?
But the food has to be good.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, and Francis and I went, you know, good reputation restaurant, which we're not going to mention, but disappointing. Disappointing to have a mediocre meal. And the meeting was important, and I'm glad we went, and, you know, we took care of things that needed to get taken care of. But it would have been so much more pleasant to have that over an interesting meal. And, frankly, it would have added, instead of only talking about business, we would have also been able to talk about the food and some other interesting things at the same time.
Well, I had a great meal, though. I wanted, you know, we don't mention when we have a bad place, a bad experience, we don't mention the place. We talk about the experience if it's illustrative of something.
Unless it's really bad.
Exactly. Well, we only mentioned one in all the years. But I went to a new place, which is a very interesting place in Manhattan. It's called Tertulia. It is owned by Seamus Mullen, who is the famous chef in New York. He's an Irish guy who made a name for himself at Boca Ria. There are two Boca Rias in Manhattan.
All right,
great.
Now I'm going to ask a question. Are you ever going to say anything bad about a restaurant owned by a guy named Seamus? Is that ever going to happen? Tell the truth.
No, we don't say bad things about individual restaurants. But let's put it this way. There are plenty of Irish people cooking bad food in the world that
I
we can talk about.
True.
So we got to celebrate them when they're not. But Seamus is interesting. He's a Spanish chef. He cooks tapas, and his tapas places were great. He's branched out. He's left.
Hold on. He's a Spanish chef named Seamus.
Seamus Mullen. He's an Irish chef that cooks Spanish food.
All right.
And he made a name for himself at Boca Ria in Manhattan. You've been to Boca Ria with me. We love the food.
That's great.
And the wine and the sherry. We went to his new place called Tertulia, which I read about. And it's from a region of Spain, which I was unfamiliar with, where there are cider houses. I'm thinking cider house. Well, I didn't know much about Spanish cider, but evidently cider houses are casual tapas places in Spain. And I thought, well, this is great. So
what a great idea for the Northeast.
Yeah,
let's open one in New Hampshire.
A cider house.
Yeah,
a cider house rules, man. Sorry.
Oh, come on.
Sorry, that was a great idea, Mark. We went to the cider house. It was a great evening. I have recently befriended a woman who is a soloist dancer for the New York City Ballet, who's terrific. So,
befriended a.
Yes, she and her boyfriend and Christy and I went to. She invited us to great seats at the ballet. We saw Swan Lake in its limited run, as you can imagine, totally sold out after the Black Swan. It was a week long run. It was an amazing ballet, and we went down to Tertulia for a casual dinner afterwards. I walk in, and they were very helpful. They were very nice, and I loved everything. So don't misconstrue what I'm about to say. I said, hey, you know, well, we're all here. We'll have some cider. We'll start with some cider, and we'll look at the wine list. And so the sommelier comes over. I hope I'm not getting anybody in trouble. He said, so you would like the cider? I said, yeah. I said, have you had the cider before here? I said, no. I said, do you know much about Spanish cider? I said, no, and that's funny because I've lived in Spain for a while. I know a lot about Spanish wine and sherry, but I don't know much about Spanish cider. He said, there's a reason you know. I said, well, he said, let me bring you four tastes of cider. I said, okay. And he brought over the four tastes of cider. I was like, that's really not very good. He said, well, you know, we like the concept of the cider house, but the cider in Spain is not very good.
Could I just share something with you?
What?
And this is requisite.
What?
Okay?
Yeah.
If we open a cider house,
yeah,
the cider house isn't going to suck. Okay? That's got to be a rule.
It was great. I loved the restaurant. And what he said was, listen, we're getting in some British cider. We're getting in some American ciders from all over. But right now we just have the Spanish cider, and we have some American cider in bottles. But it's a cider house is not about the cider.
I'm pretty sure you just got somebody in trouble.
I said I understand. Well, but I will tell you, if he hadn't done that, I might not be saying such great things about the restaurant. So he shouldn't be in trouble. He should be commended. He did it with humor. He did it with aplomb.
Made a friend.
And he made a friend. And we had great wine. We had great service. We ran up a big bill. The cider, the everything was great. I loved it. I love the place. It's called Tertulia. It's downtown Manhattan. And I would definitely check it out.
That's cool.
And you know what? I'm even going to put a link up to Tertulia on our website.
I don't know if God likes Tertulia.
Thunder in the background. You can't hear that on the radio, I don't think, but there's a little thunder going on. Hey, so one thing we do want to mention to everyone, and we have a link up on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. Not to toot our own horns, but just so you guys know, if anybody wants to come to the party, the New Jersey Restaurant Association, which is the trade association of restaurants in New Jersey, has named...
of which there are 25,000, by the way, restaurants
crazy,
in New
right?
Jersey.
We've been named, Mark and Francis have been named Restaurateurs of the Year.
A great honor.
Great,
you know? Humbling honor.
Yeah, and I'm not sure we deserve it, but we'll take it. The Restaurateurs of the Year of prior years have been friends of ours. We've known a lot of them, and it's humbling that our colleagues
to be in the same
so
group.
Much of
to
us
be in the same group really is humbling. But so more importantly, there's going to be an awesome party.
Yeah. So if anybody wants to come, you can go to njragala.com. That's the New Jersey Restaurant Association annual gala. This year will be at the Pleasantdale Chateau.
Maybe the most beautiful restaurant in New Jersey.
It was an old mansion.
For those of you who saw the movie Cocoon, the pool that was in the movie Cocoon was filmed at the Pleasantdale Chateau.
Right. One of the pool room is this awesome tile work, unbelievable thing, and it's a formal mansion on beautiful sculpted grounds, and we're going to have a black and white ball. It's going to be black tie, and
going to need a new tuxedo.
Mine still fits. Thank you very much. But it's black and white ball at this great old mansion, and there's going to be a little treasure hunt, and there's going to be great cocktails, and there's going to be great wine and food, and it should be just a terrific, terrific evening. And even for some, I think there's some folks that are staying overnight. They have rooms there.
I think it's
like $1 million if you want to stay overnight. But
it's half a million, somewhere in there.
Sounds like
somewhere
it. But if you want to come to the party, I think it's $225
a
head. It's an excuse to wear a tuxedo.
And and the money goes to the New Jersey Restaurant Association, so the profits from the evening. So, you know, it's a great organization
I don't know. I save this to the radio because I don't even know if you know this, but I grew up in that area of the state. And when I was in high school, maybe a sophomore in high school, I used to go to that estate that was owned by, I think it's Allied Chemical. It was the old Allied Chemical estate because it was the old mansion of the founder of Allied Chemical.
No, it's the DuPonts.
No, it was Allied Chemical.
Oh,
it was the DuPonts. I gave you that misinformation.
You're the one who gave me that misinformation.
But it was the Allied Chemical estate. It was the founder of Allied Chemical had been the guy who had the mansion built 100 years ago. And then it had been the Allied Chemical estate. He willed it to the company, and then they sold it to the Knowles family, who operate it now as a restaurant. The Knowles are great restaurateurs. And it was a corporate retreat and training center and, you know, fancy place. There are maids' quarters off from the main house, or there were anyway when I was growing up. And a friend of mine, her mom was a maid there. And so I used to go to the Allied Chemical Estate occasionally to visit my friend Lori. But let's put it this way. We were the kids behind the maid's quarters. And it's funny because I remember being 15 or 16 and thinking, wouldn't it be so cool to get invited, like to go to this house as like a person who belongs here and not in the maid's quarters? And we get to do that. There's a party for us at the Pleasantdale Chateau.
And I just figured something out, Francis.
What's that?
It's all coming together for me now.
What's that?
You stopped swimming in the cocoon pool.
Yeah, maybe we can take a little dip while we're there. So if you want to find out more about that or you want to come and party with us, it is the Monday after Thanksgiving, and the website to find out more is njragala.com. And drop us an email if you're coming. We'd like to be sure and hang out with you as well. Listen, we'll be back in just a moment. We're going to have a conversation with Lucy Lean. She's written a book called Made in America, Our Best Chefs Reinvent Comfort Food, and it's terrific, and I can't wait to talk to her. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on RestaurantGuysRadio.com and the Heritage Radio Network. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, The Restaurant Guys, and our guest today is Lucy Lean, and she is here to discuss her book, Made in America, Our Best Chefs Reinvent Comfort Food.
Lucy, welcome to the show.
Pleasure to be here.
So you are you grew up around food, yes?
I did. I grew up on a farm in Devon, and then in my early adult life, I moved to New York to be with my husband, whose father is a chef and had a restaurant in New York called La Côte Basque.
Yeah,
a tiny little,
a cute little place, yeah.
You know, cute little hole in the wall.
For Alain Ducasse a few years back.
Yeah, yeah. It's a lovely restaurant. And now, that's not all for you, though. You were a contributor to Meat Paper. You're a contributor to the LA Weekly. You're a food judge for Gordon Ramsay's show, MasterChef, yes?
I was. Well, I still am. I'm about to go out on the road again for season three. So I go out around America, and I taste the food that contestants bring in and basically judge whether they can cook.
So now, how do you go from that and being a British person, and comfort food is different depending on where you came from, usually, and now you write a book on American comfort food. What sparked your interest in it, and how did you discover it?
Well, I think we all love comfort food, whether you come from England or America or France. Or, you know, comfort food is universal. And one of the things that struck me when I was going around America and tasting all this food for MasterChef was just the range of food and the recipes, but also the kind of heritage of American food and how most of it has actually come from elsewhere.
So what makes something comfort food, though? I mean, you know, kimchi is not comfort food to me, but it might be to somebody else.
Well, that's an interesting question. I had a long discussion with Wolfgang Puck about comfort food, and he actually ended up giving me two recipes for the book, one for Old World comfort food, which is his recipe for goulash, which he grew up eating as a child, and the other is his Chinese chicken salad, which he sees as kind of New World comfort food for eating in California when it's a hot, sunny day. Most people think of comfort food as quite heavy food, I think,
mm-hmm.
and sort of something that you'll eat when the weather gets a bit cooler, but then, you know, there's also comfort food if you live in a hot climate, too. I mean, America has a whole range.
So does a hamburger count as comfort food?
Oh, yeah. I have burgers in the book. I have a delicious bacon burger with chipotle mustard, mayonnaise from Boston.
And how close, and I think these are closely related phenomena, but I'm curious about your take on it. How close is comfort food and hangover food?
Oh, I would say they go hand in hand.
Well, I need to be comforted when I have a hangover. That's
and I
for
think
certain.
There are a lot of recipes in the book that would be very, very good if you have the worst hangover ever. And whether it's I have a lot of really great breakfast food in there, which I always think is great for a hangover. But then I also have a lot of chocolate recipes.
You know,
well.
you were doing comfort food and you know, chefs reinventing comfort food. And all I could think about is, you know, every chef I know, you know, loves to go to a diner at 4 o'clock in the morning and order some greasy eggs and hash browns and, you know, French toast and bacon. You know, I was surprised that the book wasn't laden with more stuff like that. It was a much more diverse book than I anticipated it being.
Well, I couldn't just do a book about bacon.
Sure you could.
It's a thought.
There you go. I have your next book written.
Next one.
Well, now, go ahead.
I was just going to say that the food that you eat in the restaurants that these chefs are preparing on a day-to-day basis isn't necessarily what they're going to cook for themselves when they go home at night.
Now, you have written that this is 100 plus recipes from America's top chefs, and these are based mostly on recipes that were that are old recipes. I think that's part of being comfort food, right? Recipes inspired from the late 1800s.
Yeah, I was looking at American food from the point of view of old recipes, whether it's handed down from your grandmother or whether it's from... I actually delved into a whole bunch of really old American cookbooks, and I took some of the recipes from these old cookbooks and gave them to the chefs today and asked them to reinvent the recipe so that a home cook could cook these recipes. I don't know if you've seen an 1800s recipe, but it looks like a tweet.
It's
140 characters, and God knows how they actually were able to cook from these recipes. They must have been amazing cooks, is what I...
Gut the goat, put him over fire until done, sprinkle with seasoning, and serve.
You're laughing. That's what they are. It's like, take the rabbit, skin, put it in the oven, and serve.
Yeah. I think one of the great things about your book is where you put those in a little insert in what the recipes are. Our first experience was we actually copied a friend of ours who's a chef who now owns Shin Vineyards out on Long Island, but he used to own Home Restaurant in Manhattan. He and his Barbara Shin and David Page, they inspired us to sort of follow along in the 300th anniversary of the first American cookbook by Amelia Simmons, or the 200th
right.
anniversary?
I think it was the 200th.
200th anniversary of the first American cookbook by Amelia Simmons.
1996 we did that.
And so we got the Amelia Simmons cookbook, and this is in the age before, you know, the internet was as present as it is. And, you know, the recipes were for, you know, a shrub or whatever sort of cooking it was. And they would list sort of the ingredients, but, you know, the rest was really up to you. You had to be a good cook in order to read a cookbook. It was more of an inspiration.
Well, and you also had to find a turtle.
That's true.
What's interesting is I actually have a recipe from Amelia Simmons in the book. It's from 1798.
That's right.
And it's from basically her cookie recipe was what inspired chocolate chip cookies from Ruth Graves Wakefield, who was at the Toll House Inn in 1937.
Yeah, I read that.
He used a butter drop dough, which, I mean, it's literally 3.5 lines in terms of the ingredients and the instructions. But this is what she used to inspire her chocolate chip cookies. And then I've used that against Elizabeth Pruitt's chocolate oatmeal walnut freezer cookies, which is like the ultimate chocolate chip cookie.
Well, let's talk about the recipes in the book, because I think there are a number of different categories, and you never know quite what you're going to get when you give some of these great chefs, you know, license to reinterpret something. I think we get some unexpected reinventions. I think we just get some of it is not really a reinvention of comfort food at all. It's just maybe a mark of quality or presentation that the chef brings to something that's indeed very familiar. I mean, you have, I think, Ethan Stoll's soft-boiled duck eggs with nettle pesto and porcini right. Parmigiano Reggiano. They look really familiar, just really well done. That presentation was amazing. But then you go to Wiley Dufresne's cream cheese scrambled eggs with kumba and liquid smoke on our bagel chips and salmon, and you think, those names sound familiar, but what the hell is this?
I'm not comforted.
There you go. I think that the Wiley scrambled eggs recipe is a really good example, because you're taking a chef like Wiley who's really into molecular gastronomy and cooking right at one of the extreme ends of the spectrum, and then you're giving him a recipe that all home cooks can make, scrambled eggs, and he's elevating it. And you can cook his scrambled eggs without having the fat smoked salmon threads, but the smoked salmon threads are actually really easy to make, and they keep. One of the things that Wiley wanted to do was bring in some texture by using some crushed bagel chips, and he was really funny. He was like, you know, we shouldn't have to apologize for using a store-bought component of the recipe.
Well, I think especially in comfort food, that's definitely the case.
And especially when you're cooking at home. I mean, if I'm going to charge you $39 an entree, I'm going to apologize for giving you a store-bought component. If I'm not charging you a thing and making you breakfast in the morning at my house, I'm not going to apologize for using a store-bought ingredient.
But also, he can make bagel chips in the back of his restaurant because he has that most amazing deli slicer, which he can slice the bagels to a thin enough thing. You can't do that as a home cook mm-hmm. in your own kitchen, so it makes more sense to go out and buy a pack of bagel chips.
In all of the chefs that you brought this to, and this is a really thick book, and it's a wonderful book to have at home because all of these things are doable at home and are comfortable at home. And some of them are, you know, just the best damn popovers you're going to find from BLT Steak, which is, I've always wondered about that recipe, and I'm glad I finally have it. And some of them are sort of reinventions like Wiley's Food. What surprised you most in responses? What was there? Is there anything in this book that you thought, oh my God, that's just crazy?
Crazy as in the food is crazy? Or
well, as in, you know, what surprised you as a response? What surprised you as a dish? What did you find unexpected and delightful?
I think apart from the fact that most of the recipes, when I got them back to recipe test, produced huge amounts of food, so had to be cut down to size, I think that the nicest thing was that the chefs were willing and generous enough to share the kind of insider knowledge that they have. I didn't come across any chefs who were just kind of secret and guarded, and I think that's telling in terms of their profession and who they are.
You know, I think as you go up the ladder and you get chefs who are more accomplished and you get chefs who really do have a true confidence, you start to see that. You start to see them, you know what, I'm going to be great at what I do whether you have my recipes or not, and I'm going to continue to be great and I'm going to continue to invent. So they're less guarded. The more confident they are, the less guarded they are with those types of secrets, as it were.
I think they also really love to share, and they love the fact that people want to cook their food, but they want people to be able to cook their food in such a way that it's going to be as delicious as if they cooked it with them, kind of thing. And I think they don't want to hold back. There's no such thing as holding back the secret ingredient or you know, the final thing, that the knob of butter that takes it over the edge, kind of thing. I think they really want to be able to show people how to make their recipes in the best possible way.
You know, we have our business partner is a guy named Lou Rivera, and Lou was hanging out with a famous chef, Georges Perrier, I believe it was, and this is many years ago, got to be 20 years ago now. And he was sitting with Georges Perrier in his restaurant, and someone came over and asked for a recipe, and Georges Perrier kind of quickly gave it to them. And Lou said to George, he said, George, you know, anytime anyone asks you for a recipe, you give it. You know, aren't you afraid that they're going to steal your dishes? And he said, Luis, if Picasso is sitting at the table and, you know, someone comes over and says, excuse me, Picasso, how do you paint Guernica? And Picasso tells them how to paint Guernica. You think they can go home and paint Guernica? And I thought, yeah, I get it. That's it. It's not about the secret recipe anymore.
It's not about the secret recipe. It's also about technique as well. And I think one of the nice things in the book is that the chefs have shared tips to things to look out for or things to add in that will make the biggest difference. I mean, Alain Ducasse talked about making sure that your knives are really sharp, which is a really fundamental thing that any chef will tell you. I mean, they don't share knives. They, you know, their knives are their tools.
Yeah.
And he talked about making sure the knife was really, really sharp to reduce the tears when
you're cutting the onions. So the onions don't get into your eyes, yeah.
Right, exactly. And that's the sort of thing that most home cooks across America won't consider, but that's a really, you know, small tip that he can give you that will help in terms of cutting all those onions for French onion soup. That's a really important part of it that you don't often get when you just get a list of ingredients and a set of instructions.
You know, it's funny. People say to me all the time, they say, I don't want to have, you know, really sharp knives at home because they're dangerous. And, of course, what people don't realize is that a dull knife is more dangerous than a sharp knife.
Much more dangerous.
Because either one can cut you, but the sharp knife is going to go where you point it, and the dull knife might bounce off and go into your finger. I did that, and then I sharpened all the knives in my sister's house, and then she cut her finger with the knife and had to go to the hospital. And so
she assigned you some blame, didn't she?
I don't want her to use knives anymore.
But I've seen a shift over the last 20 years, that we've owned restaurants. And I think that chefs are now more generous with their recipes than they were 20 years ago. Do you find the same thing, Lucy?
I don't know. I wasn't asking chefs for their recipes 20 years ago. But I think that going around the country and talking to chefs about where we are today in terms of the food scene and you know, local food bloggers and Yelp and all of these things that oftentimes in the press we hear chefs complaining about them, they actually also, the other side of that is there's a huge interest in food, and the chefs are really enjoying that, I think. They have now become much more like rock stars, for want of a better term, but they're there to kind of be appreciated in a certain way that they weren't 20 years ago.
I think that's completely true. Hey, listen, Lucy, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back on the other side talking with Lucy Lean about her book, Made in America, Our Best Chefs Reinvent Comfort Food. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on RestaurantGuysRadio.com and the Heritage Radio Network. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. It's The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. Our guest is Lucy Lean. Her book is Made in America, Our Best Chefs Reinvent Comfort Food. This is a pretty thick and stately book on comfort food. Do you find that all of these recipes are fairly easy to make at home? Is that part of being comfort food?
I think the accessibility factor was really high on my list of priorities writing the book. I took all of the recipes back into my little kitchen and made sure that I could cook them up. And because I follow recipes, I love cookbooks, and if there's a well-written recipe, I think that anybody can cook from a recipe book. And so I really wanted it to be a recipe that you could look at and just think, wow, I really could do this. If I take the time to buy the ingredients and prep them properly, I can throw it all together and something will come out and it will look the same as the photograph in the book.
Well, now let's talk about books overall, because I think there is a real role for good, hardcover, keepable books like this in a person's kitchen. Now, I'm 46 years old, so I don't know if that's just a function of me being me. I do occasionally, or me being, you know, that age and of that generation, I do occasionally like to use the computer to look up a recipe or to look at a couple of different people's recipes on a certain thing and then decide how to do it on my own. But I also have in my kitchen a bookcase with hardcover books on it, and I think they serve a different role than having to look stuff up online. There's sort of a frame of reference, and they're tangible, and I think that a book like this is important, and it's important that it is a solid book in your kitchen. What do you think about cookbooks in an era of online recipes and
Kindles?
And just a computer where you can look up anything at any time. Why do you think people need to have a book and keep it as a reference in their kitchen?
I mean, I use both. I'm a huge fan of cookbooks, and I actually need to cull because I have a kind of stack, and I feel like my house might fall down in the middle because they're so heavy. But I also use my iPad in the kitchen and to look up recipes. But there's nothing like cooking from a cookbook. And one of the things that I really love and what I really want for my cookbook is for people to use it and for it to get really smudged and kind of crumbs down the spine when you open it up at a certain page. And I love the fact that if you kind of let it fall open, it will fall open as a recipe that you go back to and use again and again and
mm-hmm.
again.
Well, you know, for me, cooking is very tactile.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So and books are very tactile. You know, they're an iPad is not very tactile. A book is very tactile. So for me, cooking from a cookbook or from a big old tome that's folded open to just the right spot on the counter, I don't know. There's something that I really enjoy about it, and maybe that's comfort cooking.
Yeah.
You know, maybe I'll write a book about comfort cooking instead of comfort foods.
Right, and I also think that having the book with every single recipe in my book has a photograph to go with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's also a really good way of helping a home cook to kind of aspire. Like, you too can cook something and it can look as beautiful as this.
Right.
And you don't get that so much on the internet. You have a lot of blogs where they do, like, step-by-step photographs showing you what to do and everything. But there's something about having a book on the countertop right next to you with a photograph and following those instructions that you don't get by doing it on the iPad.
And I also think there's something to going to a certain book. And again, I think that maybe 10 years from now or 20 years from now, your kids, Mark, are not going to feel this way about books and will be like the old men in the kitchen.
You're wrong. My kids love books. Yeah. They have each of my children probably has a collection of books that's 1,000 books.
Because there's just something about, and especially with cookbooks, when I go, I mean, the Good Housekeeping Cookbook, which is sort of a comprehensive cookbook, Mark Bittman's Cook Everything, I think that's a reference that you know, maybe translates well to the internet. But a book like this that has a food of a certain feel that you're looking for, I mean, I sometimes when I'm going to cook dinner for people coming over, I'll gravitate to a certain book on my shelf. Barbara Shin and David Page's book, Cooking from Home, is a book that I go to all the time. Because, you know, there may be hundreds of recipes in there, but that's sort of the feel I'm going for that night.
But I said it before, you know, there's, you know, we're talking about comfort foods here. There are certain books that when I cook from it, it's more comforting to cook from that book than it is even to cook, even though I know the recipe, than it is to cook without that book sitting there on the counter.
I also think when you have a really delicious cookbook, you can flick through it, and maybe there's one recipe that you've gone to cook, but then you come across another recipe and you think, oh, right, I really want to try that recipe. And you don't get the same experience from the Kindle, for instance, because it doesn't have that thing of actually turning the page and holding the book and splattering it with butter or whatever you
I actually sometimes will, if you want to buy one of these books from us, we'll pre-splatter it with butter for you. No, I'm kidding.
For those of you who don't
sign a book and splatter it with
nice
butter.
You should
nice.
Sign
that's
the book in, you should sign the book in butter.
I could also do that.
Yeah, that'd be good.
Yeah, for those of you who don't know me, I am an extraordinary splatterer.
Yeah, often accidental. He also has a collection of ties that have been splattered that you could pick up at a steep
so
discount.
So sad, but true.
There you go.
All right, so, Lucy, if do you have a favorite recipe? I know it's a Sophie's Choice moment, but do you have a favorite recipe from your book?
Like, do I have a favorite child?
Yes. Well, do you have a favorite recipe in this book?
I love the shepherd's pie recipe from Brendan Collins, just because shepherd's pie to me is quite English, so it bridges that gap. But also just the way he elevates it, he puts all little baby vegetables on the top of it, and it's just super delicious and very easy to make. I love that recipe. There's a whole bunch I love. I mean, Ludo's fried chicken in duck fat. Can't beat that recipe. Shouldn't eat it very often. I'm sure it's not.
Duck fat is like a magic food, isn't it?
Oh, it's like heavenly. You can feel the angels singing as you eat it.
I don't know if it's the angels or the devils. I'm not exactly certain which one it is. Hey,
maybe
so
I don't know. The Michael White gnocchi recipe is beyond. I don't know. It's just the flavor of it. And when I was recipe testing, I gave it to a friend of mine who claims she doesn't cook, but she will follow a recipe down to the last little tiny minute detail.
Uh-huh.
And they actually came out perfectly, and they were delicious, and it was like the recipe to end all recipes. But it is butter, cream, cheese, eggs on top of butter, cream, cheese, eggs.
I'm thinking of a song, and it goes like, these are a few of my favorite things, I'm
right,
pretty
exactly.
sure.
The hell with whiskers on kittens. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
So would you mind if we put the shepherd's pie recipe up on restaurantguysradio.com with a link to your book?
Oh, no, definitely do that. I will get it to you if you need any extra photographs or any of extra details in terms of recipes and things.
So as soon as you're done listening to this show, you should go to restaurantguysradio.com, click on Lucy Lean's episode with Made in America, Our Best Chefs Reinvent Comfort Food, and you will see her recipe for shepherd's pie, which is one of my favorites as well. Lucy, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks, Lucy.
Thanks, guys.
And I hope that you guys have enjoyed this hour as much as I have. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on the Heritage Radio Network and on restaurantguysradio.com. Hi, this is Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants and also of The Restaurant Guys Radio Show. You know, one of the best things about the restaurant business is the creative side of it. Coming up with big ideas and then turning those concepts into reality is awesome. It's what I love most about what I do. But it can't stop there. If you can't communicate exactly what it is you're doing, then you'll find yourself standing alone in your dining room, just you and your big ideas. The Mardini Group can help you get your ideas across to others. The Mardini Group is a boutique graphic design firm, and they do extraordinary work. We use them, and as you know, we only use the best. Whether it's menu design, product packaging, a corporate report, promo material, a homepage, or an awesome logo for a brand new project like Catherine Lombardi, we turn to the Mardini Group.
Some small business owners don't realize how important it is to have a strong visual identity. Without it, you come across as less than professional. That can cost you trust, and that lowers your bottom line. First impressions count for a lot, and that's why you need the Mardini Group. Go to RestaurantGuysRadio.com and click on the Mardini Group link, or call them at 718-694-9944. The Mardini Group for graphic design. 718-694-9944.
Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys.
Prince, I'm just remembering some of the words to that song.
Love that accent, by the way.
Butter on French toast with bacon and foie gras. Doesn't it kind of go like that?
Mark Pascal opening soon at the State Theater in New Brunswick.
Those are favorite few of my favorite things.
Yeah, you know? Whiskers on Kittens is out, is what it is. You know, it's funny. I like this idea of comfort food. I like the idea of comfort food at home. I'm completely over... Not completely over. I am generally over making fancy, elaborate dishes at home.
It's a lot of work. It's a lot of time. I do like to do it occasionally for a dinner party, but for me, let a great chef do that. Go out to a great restaurant.
And you know what? Be inspired by that. Again, I like Mark Bittman's idea. He has a number of books where he takes these great recipes, these great complex recipes from these great chefs, and does like a down and dirty version of it under an hour. Mm-hmm. And I like that. And I'll tell you why I like that in my home. I really like comfort food. Of course, I do occasionally bring foie gras home from the restaurant. Yeah. But you know what?
It is comforting.
For me, the thing about it's not comfort food. It's simple food. Mm-hmm. But honestly, look. Searing a lobe of foie gras and throwing it in a pan with some apples and some spices is something that – it's certainly not comfort food for most people, and it's something that people think of as very complex. But it's about what you know. You know, I can throw a sear together a piece of foie gras. It's not that difficult, and I can bring the foie gras home from the restaurant so I don't have to go to a specialty store to get it. But it's about, for me – being able to, when I'm cooking at home, spend some time cooking, and my kitchen is set up so that my guests can be with me in the kitchen when I'm cooking. But I want to sit down. I want to be with the guests. I don't want to spend the whole time in a complicated operation that I have to concentrate on. And frankly, when I go to your house, I'm more interested in spending time with you than
Absolutely.
I am with you showing me the food that you can cook.
Well, that we cheat, too. Realize that we get great food by – calling the chef and saying, send us some great food, and 8 minutes later, great food shows up.
Right, or the raw ingredients takes your great food, set up in such a way that it's like a cooking show. All the mise en place is done, and that's a great advantage that we have. But again, I want to spend more time with the person I'm visiting or with the people who are visiting me.
So I've been thinking through this whole show, and even when I was preparing for the show, what do I think of, what is comfort food to me? And I realize now what it is for me, and I think it's different for every person. But for me, comfort food is going to be carbohydrate, going to have a lot of carbohydrates. It's going to be kind of weighty that way. And that kind of food gives me like kind of a rush. It makes me feel good. It makes me, you know, I there's definitely something about food that's kind of high in carbohydrates and you know, it's got to have a little bit of fat. Those are the comfort foods that I have. That's you know, pastas and breads and mashed potatoes. And those are the foods that I connect with comfort food.
See, to me, short ribs will go in that category of comfort food. Anything
only
braised,
if they're over mashed potatoes.
Braised and slow cooked. I like mashed potatoes. And it's funny she mentioned shepherd's pie, but to me, I mean, I'm Irish, right? Shepherd's pie, like a good shepherd's pie, is very much comfort food to me.
Yeah.
Very much.
Lasagna.
Lasagna
is comfort food to me, no question about it.
You know, and the potatoes in Ireland are a little different than the potatoes here. They're more almost floury, pasty, white, and you know, I'm living with my cousin.
Like the Irish.
kind of. And my cousin lives with me. My cousin who grew up in Ireland, and he's staying with me for a while. And, you know, I'll come home and there'll be potatoes cooked in the, you know, it's just, it's a very, on a cold day, especially, like she said, on a cold day, we go back to, you know, those rich foods, and they work. It's nice. Anyway, the book is great, and it has a lot of suggestions for things that I think most people will find comforting and, again, easy to make at home. So that's my advice, is leave the fancy stuff for the restaurants out. Hey, listen, I hope you've enjoyed the hour as much as we have. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys on RestaurantGuysRadio.com and the Heritage Radio Network.